Gregory Wolfe is the publisher and editor of Image, a journal of the arts and religion, and director of the Center for Religious Humanism. He has published essays, reviews, and articles in numerous journals, including First Things, National Review, Crisis, Regeneration Quarterly, and American Outlook. Greg is also the editor of the New Religious Humanists, a reader, and he's the co-author of Books That Build Character, Climb High, Climb Far, The Family New Media Guide, and Bless This House. He received his Bachelor of Arts from Hillsdale College and his Master of Arts in English Literature from Oxford University. Currently writing a book on religious humanism, Greg is best known for his books, Sacred Passion, The Art of William Schickel, and his biography of Malcolm Muggeridge. For if it is true that we apprehend the spirit of an age better through the lives of great personages than through chronicles of events, Greg's beautiful biography of Muggeridge, whose life spanned the entire past century and who was so involved in the personalities and events that shaped it, his beautiful biography gives us a profound insight into the meaning of the 20th century. Greg Wolfe.
Thank you, Annette. I came to my first Philadelphia Society in 1977 when I was a 17-year-old freshman at Hillsdale College. So for me to be able to stand behind the podium and look at it in this direction is a great honor. I'm going to call my little presentation Banishing Falstaff. Stan Evans raised the question on Friday evening about the criticism of conservatism of whether it has died or not. I don't know that there's a definitive answer to that, but I'm tempted to paraphrase the immortal Frank Zappa, who is commenting on jazz, and my adaptation would be, conservatism isn't dead, it just smells funny. I think our movement has to have the maturity and has to have the strength of character to admit that things aren't going that well these days, that we are in a slump, that there has been a kind of a cycle of rise and fall. If we're not strong enough to say that, if we're not honest enough to see it, if we're not passionate enough to do something about it, then I think we will have to answer for that at some tribunal or other. It's not so much that we lack the great original thinkers who have gone on. It's not just that it's hard to match the brilliance of a Russell Kirk or a Richard Weaver or an Eric Voegelin or a Leo Strauss. It's that we've allowed ourselves to reverse our priorities as a movement and to take that definition of ideology, which was such an essential part of the coherence of conservatism as a movement, and dangerously veer into an ideological movement itself. It seems to me that we have allowed ourselves to move from being political philosophers and theologians and historians and recreators of the vision of what is a good life to merely culture warriors. We've allowed politics to dominate culture. We've forgotten that culture is prior to politics. And there's been a thinning and a narrowing out of this movement. And I think it's time to turn that around. And if groups like this cannot face that forthrightly, then that is, I think, bad news indeed. And I happen to believe there is a direct connection between that triumph of politics over culture and the very lack of interest in literature and the arts that has been characteristic of this movement for 20 years. Because literature and the arts are the ultimate anti-ideological force. They call us to question even ourselves. This is Sunday morning, so I can preach a bit here. Literature and art do not come up with propositional answers. They question things. They deal in ambiguity. They deal in irony. They deal in tragedy. And a political movement that seeks triumph, that seeks to win, that seeks power, is in constant danger of being threatened by art. Art is subversive in the best sense, not in the ideological sense of Schoenberg, not in that abstract, inhuman kind of subversion, which is truly an evil kind of subversion, but I think a good subversion, a spiritual subversion. It stops us from being too proud. It attacks our hubris. It reminds us of our human limitations. That, to me, is the essence of what conservatism is all about. That awareness of evil, that awareness of human limitations. If we stray too far from that kind of humility, then we are in a serious amount of problem. I think there are six obstacles that I'd like to quickly point out to a healthier relationship between conservative movement as an organized phenomenon and the world of literature and art. The first is that we have to stop taking an attitude towards the arts of utilitarianism. There's a temptation to say, who are the good artists who communicate our message? And in particular, I think sometimes a naive notion that a certain literary or artistic figure who is politically conservative ought to be considered aesthetically superior, which is not always the case. It often is. I mean, take a look at the novelist Mark Helprin, who is one of the most brilliant literary figures of our time. He has been forthright. He's a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. He is somebody who wrote speeches for Bob Dole, tried anyway. Didn't last too long, and not, I think, ultimately because he was a prima donna, but because of the very political narrowing of that ill-fated campaign. But we have to be careful that we do not seek to make art propaganda, that we do not wish it to be simply another salvo in our culture war battle. That is to narrow and constrict it. I use the title Banishing Falstaff. I think a clue to the kind of danger that we fall lies in how we look at that great Shakespearean tetralogy, Richard II, Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and Henry V. If we look at Henry V in the sort of Laurence Olivier version as the great triumphant good king who kicks butt and wins the day, which of course Olivier had a strong reason to want to do in the darkest days of World War II to rally his people, we are going to fall into, I think, this kind of triumphalist ideology. This tetralogy of plays is more like a tragedy. What you have on the one hand is a crumbling order, this medieval order represented by Richard II, and you have the new Machiavellian coming along, Bolingbroke. And you have the tension between a decayed order and an attempt to bring control to a new order. And in that midst of that story, you have the story of Prince Hal and Falstaff. And as you know, Falstaff represents a kind of magnificent life force. And there's an energy, there's a humor, there's a capaciousness, there's an imagination, there's a playfulness to Falstaff, which Prince Hal revels in when we first meet him. But the tragic conflict of the play is what happens when you have to take power. And Prince Hal goes from being the playfellow of Falstaff to eventually becoming Henry V. But in doing so, this wonderful capaciousness of imagination is narrowed by power. And eventually, by the time he becomes Henry V, he is a brutal leader who's willing to exterminate entire cities. All we hear of Falstaff is that he's died offstage. And the tragedy is this strange tension in the West between power and imagination. In addition to that utilitarian problem, I think that when we seek for order, when we desire as conservatives to support order in anything, in art, in society, we shouldn't take that sense of order in too literalistic a mode. I think some of the weakness of conservative aesthetics in the last 30 years has been that the only kind of art that's being promoted is what I would call neoclassical. Now, I have nothing against, I have very Catholic tastes in terms of the arts, but the notion that neoclassicism, that sort of Augustan order, provides the only kind of mode of regaining order in our arts, I think becomes a caricature of itself. We have to have a broader definition, and we have to have a subtler definition of how order can be manifested in works of art and in imaginative vision. Thirdly, I'd say there's always the danger of restorationism, of reaction, of trying to go back. And going back is great. As Chesterton said, the element, if you look at the etymology of the word reform, it means a return to form. And I think there is no great art that does not master the tradition that the individual talent must submit to and become part of. But obviously there's a difference between synthesizing that ancient wisdom with one's current circumstances and merely attempting to live in that earlier period. Fourth, I'd say that conservatives have shown a disappointing tendency towards a kind of populist attitude about art. I don't know much about art, but I know that modern art is bad, capital M, capital A, as if it was one monolithic thing dominated by sex and the occult and so on and so forth. And yet, who are some of our greatest heroes as conservatives? But people like T.S. Eliot, who worked in profoundly modern form, Igor Stravinsky, who was reviled originally as somebody who was all about chaos and all about the occult and paganism, but who became one of our greatest Christian composers. So it seems to me that if we take a mere anti-elitist attitude, sort of a Tom Wolfe aesthetic, I know there's some people who think that Tom Wolfe is our great Charles Dickens of the late 20th century. I'm sorry, that just isn't true. He's a clever man, and he makes a few good points here and there about the excesses of the art world, but he is not a great literary figure by any stretch of the imagination. I'm not promoting elitism per se, but there is such a thing as a pernicious populism. Finally, I'd say that as conservatives, we've been addicted to bad news. We love nothing better than to get together and to commiserate about how awful the world is and how it's absolutely getting worse and worse and worse every day. To vary that old iconographic form with those monkeys, it's hear no good, see no good, speak no good. And the irony is that we're missing the boat because our culture is experiencing a tremendous resurgence of creativity that is ultimately profoundly conservative and traditional, and at its best, religiously inspired. And Bob alluded to that, and we can talk about that in the question and answer period. We have to understand that we cannot assume somewhere in our hearts, as many conservatives have, that Western civilization died somewhere back there, whether it's 1832 or 1900 or 1300. There's a terrible lack of stewardship about contemporary arts and contemporary culture within conservatism. We circle our wagons and say, we're going to protect what's there, instead of renewing the culture at the source. How much money is funneled to the arts from a conservative perspective? How many of these new T.S. Eliots and Igor Stravinsky's do we help to support? The record has been abysmal, absolutely abysmal. I'll go back to something that Stephen Tonser said yesterday. There is a profound need to work at the individual level. And the arts work on the individual level. They work by changing the heart. They work in between the lines. And if we do not go back to that profoundly soul-changing vision of the arts, but make it merely a tool in our attempt to gain political power, then our conservatism will not be worth very much. And the positive side of the message, of course, the irony here is that I've just spent 10 or 15 minutes being gloomy myself. But I'm hoping that it's you know, it does feel good. But I'm trying to expropriate the expropriators. I'm trying to purge that in order to say that there is good news, and ask me about it in the Q&A.